There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, Lord, get you a ripe one. Don't get a hard one. You can plant them in the spring and eat them in the summer. A winter without them is a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and the digging. Every time I go out to pick me a big one, it's homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? The only two things that money can't buy.
Welcome to the Edible Community Show in the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains, and I have the pleasure of sharing this seat with my colleagues, Kate Manchester, the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, and Marla Camp, the publisher of Edible Austin. Every Monday, one of us, thanks to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, brings you community-based, locally-oriented stories about the farmers, growers, chefs, and the wonderful artisans that are creating all of the distinct culinary regions we're enjoying throughout the United States and Canada. And every season, we do the same through the pages of Edible Communities publications. And you can find out all about all 50 of us at ediblecommunities.com. On today's show, we'll be speaking about inspired locavores, artisan cheeses, bread on the grill, and what's growing or not in your garden. My guests include Robin McDermott. She's the co-founder of the Mad River Valley Locavore Project. Susan Reed, she's a baker extraordinaire and an employee owner of King Arthur Flour. Allison Hooper, who's the co-founder of Vermont Butter and Cheese. And Charlie Nardozzi, whose name might be familiar. He's the senior horticulturist for the National Gardening Association. So we've got a great show. I'm so excited about spending time with you today. Let's take a short break, and we'll return to speak with Robin McDermott.
When I first met you, baby, you fed me on chicken and wine. Well, it was steak and potatoes and lobster, and baby, I sure felt fine. Seaweed and alfalfa sprouts and sunflower seeds, and I've got my doubts, 'cause babe, you left me here with a chicken coat on blues. I'm sitting here thinking, but all I got is food for thought.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I'm here with my guest, Robin McDermott, and I'll tell you a little about her. Robin is the co-founder of the Mad River Valley Locavore Project, and you can tell by their name that they're a pretty inspired and dynamic group. Her mission and their mission is to celebrate and support local food in the Mad River Valley, those who eat it and those who grow it, through education, community, connections, and collective wisdom. Welcome, Robin. I'm so delighted you're here today. Robin?
Hi, Deborah. I am having a hard time hearing you. I'm sorry.
Well, can you hear me now?
I can barely hear you, but if you speak up, I'm getting a lot of static on the line.
Well, why don't we take a short break, Robin, and I'll see if we can work on that. Folks, listen to some great music, and we'll see if we can get Robin a better connection.
So funny, and I can't take no more. This food tastes so weird that the cockroaches move next door. Yeah, you see our old dog, he's out in the street. Got a big smile on his face, 'cause they let him eat meat. 'Cause babe, you left me here with the chicken coat on. with a chicken cordon blues.
Hi, Robin. How's this?
Hi, Deborah. It's better.
Okay, great. Well, welcome. Technical difficulties when we're trying to connect the universe.
Well, this is high-tech stuff here, so.
Absolutely. So, in our introduction, we talked about the fact that you're one of the co-founders of the Mad River Valley Locavore Project, and I'd love to hear a little bit of your perspective on where things have come. You started it a few years ago, and that was before locavore was a word in the dictionary. Now it seems to be on everyone's tongue, but you were a visionary, and I wondered if you could give us a little bit of a story of how you put it all together.
Sure. Well, I mean, I really wasn't a visionary. I basically followed what other people had been doing. And we started back in 2006, and I think that the year before that was when the word locavore was coined out in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a few women here in Vermont heard about it and said, well, that sounds like a cool thing. Let's try to do an Eat Local challenge here. Surely, you know, we should be able to do it. So they had a challenge in 2005 and did a little presentation at a local conference that we had here. And quite a few people attended, and I was one of them. And so we decided we'd kick off a movement in our own community here.
So it was an Eat Local challenge that got this all started.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that.
Our whole locavore movement really started with the Eat Local challenges. But what we realized out of that, and just for those who don't know, an Eat Local challenge is when people pledge to go for a period of time with eating only local food. And here in the Mad River Valley, we did that Eat Local challenge for a week. And so what we realized when people did the challenge was that there's a lot of work that we need to do in terms of finding better food sources, more food sources, a bigger variety, and also in educating people on what to do with those foods once they get them.
And now I think we could say that some of our winter farmers markets are a result of that. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that more people wanted local.
And in Vermont, I think at this point we probably have 8 or 9, maybe even 10 winter farmers markets that function at least once a month. And that's just amazing. If you talk to any of the farmers at those markets, they're going to tell you that it's all because of the enthusiasm behind the locavore movement.
Which is so exciting. You know, I noticed that you've got a lot of events and programs that you do. I sort of wondered what you're finding most successful so that our listeners and other communities who may not be as far along with this whole local movement might get some ideas of things that you find have really helped you bring folks together and find support for the local farmers. Could you share with us some of what you find most helpful?
Yeah, we do, like I said, we do the challenge, we do different educational activities. Every now and then we'll show a movie or invite people to a movie and have a discussion afterwards. But I think the biggest thing that we've done that has been really cool and that's really helped people is we hold what we call socials. So at first we thought we needed to hold workshops, but we had a hard time getting people to kind of stand up and say, oh, yeah, I'll do a workshop. Because when you do a workshop, it implies that you're the expert and no one else is in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you do, let's say, a jam-making social, all you're doing is inviting some friends over and showing them how to do something that maybe you learned from your mother or you've learned over the past few years, and you're sharing that with other people. So it takes all the pressure off of the person who's hosting it.
Mm-hmm.
And last year we probably did about 30 of those socials, and it's a great way to
learn. Wow. And what kind of attendance do you get for something like that?
It depends on the social. If it's a canning social, because we're doing them right in people's homes, we'll limit them to maybe 10 to 12 people. If we're doing them, we've done raising chicken socials where people are outside looking at chicken coops and everything, and we'll have 30 or 40 people at those. And the great thing is, because it's neighbors helping neighbors, we don't have to pay an expert to come in and run the workshop.
Right, which is, that's really, I think, how all of this was working a long time ago, which was neighbors helping neighbors, and that's a lot of what you've really brought back.
Exactly.
I wonder what sort of has you excited now. I know that you screened a wonderful movie called Food Life, and I was hoping you'd tell us a little about that. But I also wondered what some of the things are that are exciting you now that you're seeing is sort of upcoming in the movement and in the locavore movement.
Well, as far as upcoming in the locavore movement, I mean, what I've seen is it's like it's sweeping across the country. And I get calls and emails from people from all over the country asking how we got started, what did it take. I even had a group in Lansing, Michigan say, we know we could get started if we could just have your website. Will you let us use it? And I said, sure. And I just like packaged all the files up and sent them out to them.
Wow.
And they have a website that looks very much like ours now.
Fantastic. Well, it is a great site. I mean, it really, it's fun. It's easy to navigate. Let's tell folks about it. It's the VermontLocavore.org site.
Yeah.
So we spell it a little differently here.
Locavore. In Vermont, when the women did their first challenge, they knew that the folks out in California called themselves locavores without an L. And I guess they just wanted to do it a little differently, and they were concerned that people would think that loco was loco. And so in the East Coast, we call ourselves locavores, L-O-C-A-L-V-O-R-E. So our website is VermontLocavore.org.
And it's a great place to go find all types of information about what's going on. So what do you have coming up in this season? What are some of the things that you'll be doing that your folks in other communities like Wisconsin might want to be trying?
Yeah. Well, we've got a whole series of workshops. Socials. We started with a couple early this year on how to grow your own salad greens in the winter right at home, because that's one of the things that's really challenging for us in Vermont. We don't get salad greens year-round. So we had that, and we also are trying to get more people to grow more of their own food. So we had some gardening workshops on how to do raised bed square foot garden. So now we're starting to come into the season where we have food that's coming out of the garden, so we need to ask ourselves, what are we going to do with it? So we're going to have some pickling socials and some jam-making socials and how to cook different types of foods and prepare them. And then that gets us into the fall when we start thinking about how can we put food away so that we have it to eat during the winter. And then we'll get into a series of food preservation workshops, and we've got one on root cellars as well.
And so you really are following the cycles of the season.
Absolutely, yep. I mean, that's when people want to know it. People don't want to know how to do a garden in November because they're not going to be able to do anything about it until May here in
right.
Vermont.
Well, what are you looking forward to? You know, as you sort of think about how much you've, if you look back and you realize what you've accomplished in the past 3 or 4 years, what are some of the goals for the Mad River Valley Locavores moving forward?
I'm really looking forward to having our whole movement increase demand, and it really has. I mean, throughout Vermont, demand for local food is really high, and Vermont eats more local food, more food grown in Vermont than any other state in the nation. But I'm really looking for that number to go up, because as it does, it's going to create opportunities for farmers. And those farmers are then going to continue working our beautiful landscape here and keep it from being developed.
Well, we're definitely in a great, you know, you're off to a great start with what you've been able to accomplish in just the past few years. So, Robin, I know we got started a little late. I want to thank you. We're going to have to take a break, and I hope you will come back and talk to us again.
I certainly will, and thank you very much, and good luck with the show, Deborah.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. And remember to check out VermontLocavore.org. And we were just speaking with Robin McDermott. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
met you, baby, you fed me on chicken and wine. Well, it was steak and potatoes and lobster, and baby, I sure felt fine. Now all you feed me is seaweed and alfalfa sprouts and sunflower seeds, and I've got my doubts, 'cause babe, you left me here with a chicken cordon bleu. I'm sitting here thinking, but all I got is food for thought. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the 20 pounds of groceries we bought. We bought 10 pounds of brown rice and 5 more beans, 5 pounds of granola, and you know what that means. I'm just a regular fella with a chicken cordon bleu.
The Heritage Radio Network, and you're listening to the Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and I'm here with my guest, Susan Reed. For those of you who are a baking enthusiast, Susan's name will be familiar. She's been at King Arthur Flour since 2001, and that's allowed her to combine her passions for words and food. After careers in advertising and high-end restaurants and as a chef instructor at the New England Culinary Institute, Susan came to King Arthur Flour, and there she wears many hats. She's the editor of the company's highly regarded newsletter, The Baking Sheet. She teaches classes at the company's Baking Education Center, and I can tell you all, it's an incredible place. She is one of the contributors to the King Arthur Flour Cookie Companion and the King Arthur Flour Baker's Companion, and she is a co-author of the King Arthur Flour Whole Grain Baking Book. And I'm proud to say I have copies of all of those books, and I enjoy baking from each of them. So Susan's going to speak with us about a lot of topics today, including some delicious recipes and tips for breads we can make on the grill. And Susan, I want to say welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. I know you've had a busy weekend.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask you to speak up a little.
Will
You're
do.
All the way in Boston. Just so our listeners know, our King Arthur is based in Vermont, but Susan has been at a food styling conference, and I wanted to ask her, just like we see these wonderful models all airbrushed and looking beautiful on the covers of magazines, is that what's going on when we see those beautiful looking pies and cakes on the cover?
Well, it very much depends on where you're looking at this picture of the food. If you're looking at a picture of food that's on a product package, that has usually been enhanced, shall we say, in mm-hmm. some way, just because no one is, you have to stay true to what's in the package, mm-hmm. but you can also make the food look a little bit better than it would if the consumer just took it out of that package and baked it at home.
Mm-hmm.
For editorial purposes in magazines, there's a conscious decision to make the food look a little bit more authentic, like you would find it on your plate. So
and,
it just depends where you're finding it.
Tricks, or would you rather not share those with us?
Oh, I mean, well, there are plenty of things you can think about doing. If you want to make your food look a little bit nicer, there are lots and lots of tricks. A lot of people, one of the most common questions that I get is frosting on a cake. Most people will be running late and rush it, and they will try to put frosting on a cake, and it will be full of crumbs. And they won't understand how a cake that is in a photograph can look so much better. You really need to frost it in a two-stage process if you want it to look a lot neater. You take a little bit of frosting and do what's called a crumb coat. So you put a very thin, thin layer of frosting on the cake, and it looks terrible, and that's fine. And what that once you've got the cake completely covered with a very thin layer, you put it in the refrigerator. And while the frosting sets up, all of the crumbs are kept in place, and that way when you go to frost it in half an hour after the base is set, you get a much, much neater look. That's something anybody can do and that anyone would do if they wanted to take a photograph of beautiful food.
Fantastic. Well, I know there's a lot of people who are going to go and start baking as soon as we hang up and try to make a perfect birthday cake. So I did get into that question sort of quickly. I wanted to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about King Arthur. We're broadcasting this show from Vermont, but a lot of our listeners will be in other places. And perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about the product and how broadly it's distributed throughout the United States and
certainly
just some of why it's one of your favorites and so many professional bakers' favorites.
King Arthur Flour is the oldest flour company in the country. It started in 1790 when George Washington was president.
And gives us a moment in time.
There aren't that many companies in America that are that old. And King Arthur's point of view about our product has always been that it is pure, that it is high quality, and that nothing has ever been done to alterate it. One of the reasons why chefs like King Arthur Flour is that it's incredibly consistent. We have the strictest quality standards of any flour company in the country, and we are very picky about enforcing that with our suppliers. So if you bake with our flour, you're going to get the same results time after time. We are also 100% employee-owned, and we have a big commitment to educating our customers, and we love it when people bake. We don't care if they're just using a bowl and a spoon or if they're making croissants. We just love everyone who bakes and want them to do the best that they can with it.
Well, and I think that for anyone who gets to visit your website, which is kingarthurflour.com, it's all one word, they would find that what you're talking about is really true. I think your website has won some awards, correct?
Yes, we just won a multi-channel marketing award for all the different ways that we try to communicate with our customers. We have a baking blog that has what are like little baking classes. There's step-by-step instructions in all the things that we bake. We have a recipe archive that has its own search engine. There are more than 1,200 recipes that we have online. We have an entire section of baking tips and hints and techniques. So if you just want to read about flour or if you just want to read about what sugar does, there's an enormous amount of information that's waiting there for you.
Well, and one of the new things you've added, which I find really impressive, and especially in our current economy, is that you can see what it would cost if you purchased those chocolate chip cookies or rolls at the bakery and what it would cost if you'd make them at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really a very nice thing to add and a very great incentive for people.
And most people are happy to take control of their baking. They know what went into it. And we often will put lists of ingredients side by side. And when you make it at home from scratch, there are a lot fewer ingredients that have lots and lots of syllables in them that no one knows what they are.
Well, and I wanted to ask a little bit about that because it is interesting, you know, the way a home-baked bread might not last as long. You sort of notice that.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, in some of your recipes and in your catalog, I know, have some interesting products like the there's dough enhancers or the Easy Roll Dough Improver.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about those types of things for the home baker.
What some of the things that we sell, things like a dough enhancer or a dough improver, those are usually natural ingredients that when you add a little extra, some of them are a little bit of extra inactive yeast. Sometimes it's something as simple as powdered dried milk. It will make the dough relax and be easier to work with. We have things like rye bread improver. When people are trying to make a really deli-style rye, we have ingredients in there that help give it that tang that you're trying to get by yourself. You can also use dill pickle juice, frankly.
There's another tip.
Yeah.
That people may not have known.
We have things like lecithin or We have something called High Maize, which is it's an all-natural product, but it's a cornstarch derivative that does not get digested, and all it does is add fiber to whatever it is that you're baking. It's kind of inert.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to increase the amount of fiber in the bread that you bake, you add a little bit of this, and no one knows, and you are increasing your fiber intake.
And how do you test all of this at King Arthur?
Yes. I work in the test kitchen, and there are five of us in there at any given time. I work across the kitchen from the team that comes up with all of the recipes and tests all of these ingredients, and it's really fun to toss things back and forth and experiment and discuss what it does and how to work with it. And once we figure it out, then we're able to write recipes for people so that they know how to work with those ingredients.
Well, and I actually have had the pleasure of walking through that test kitchen, and one of the fun things is, what is it you say? If you bite, you write. If you bite, you write. But I think we'd probably have a lot of listeners who'd be more than happy to come by and take a bite. And I did promise in our intro that we'd talk a little bit about some recipes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are also all available at the KingArthurFlour.com website. In anticipating our conversation, I actually made one last night. I made the semolina flatbread,
mm-hmm.
and it was remarkably easy. I happen to be a little bit yeast phobic, I call it. I'm not very comfortable baking with yeast on an ongoing basis, but this really turned out well. And I wondered if you could share with us a little bit about how you develop these grilled breads. And I guess they've been in other cultures for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
but it seems sort of new to us here in the States.
Yeah, we get a little spoiled sometimes in American society, and not all baking has to happen in an oven. In many cultures, baking happens with fire and a hot rock. So a lot of breads that can be baked that way, you can recreate that at home on your own charcoal grill. If you have a pizza stone, you can put the pizza stone on the grate of your grill before you light it, and it will warm up as the grill comes to temperature, and then you can mix your dough. These breads are usually flatbreads. They're not expected to hold a big loaf shape,
mm-hmm.
because you're really cooking them only on one side at a time. So once you've mixed your dough, a lot of the flatbreads are less intimidating because you don't have to decide when it's perfectly risen or whatever. If you just give it an hour to get itself started, and then it's supposed to be good and flat, so you don't
mm-hmm.
have to worry about it being tall and majestic. Or shaping it, you can just take a piece of the dough, make a nice round ball with it, and then press it flat with your hand. After that, it's just a question of putting it on the hot stone, or you can, if you're brave and adventurous, you can scrub off your grill and put the bread right on the hot grill, and the dough will firm up quite quickly, and you can get some nice grill marks on the bread, and then transfer it to the stone, close the lid of your grill, and the grill will work just like an oven, and you'll get a wonderful, smoky, outdoor sort of flavor, and you can have fresh, warm bread that did not heat up your entire oven in the middle of August.
Well, and it really doesn't take long. I mean, once you mix the dough, like you said, you put it in the fridge for just about an hour. And I was going to ask, can you over-rise dough in that way if it's in the fridge?
Well, it's much less likely to happen. There are some yeast doughs that can stay in the refrigerator. Very often we tell people if they want to make cinnamon rolls, they can mix the dough, let it rise one time, shape it, and then put it in the refrigerator overnight. And it will rise very slowly, and then it'll be just right to bake off first thing in the morning. So yeast doughs are much more forgiving. You can control how fast they're moving with temperature pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So you can stop and start yeast if you want to.
And how do you do that?
Well, if you say, here's an example. I have about a 45-minute drive between my work and my home. So if I'm having pizza for dinner that night, and this is the virtue of actually working in a kitchen, I mix up the dough, I throw it in a plastic bag that has been sprayed inside with pan spray, and I drive it home. And it gets its first rise on the drive home. And it's perfectly fine. When I get home, I shape my pizza, I put my toppings on it, I bake it, and dinner is ready. So
It doesn't have to be an all-day affair.
It's much more forgiving than you would believe. You could make a starter, some doughs, to make extra flavor and to keep it from going. Besides extra flavor, it will also keep the bread from going stale, but we will mix equal amounts of flour and water with an eighth of a teaspoon of yeast. Just mix it up. It's like pancake batter. You cover it and let it sit on the counter overnight, and that little teeny tiny bit of yeast will make what's called a sponge. And there are all kinds of flavor is going on in there because yeast has had all this time to work. And that will be the beginning of a dough that you could make after that. So, and then once you've made that dough, you could put it in the refrigerator for 12 hours, 24 hours. It would still work.
And I also wanted to ask you what you do with leftover bread that you like. Do you have any? I mean, I know there's the croutons there, but what are some of the things people can do when there's some bread left over that they may not be
thinking? I do several things with leftover bread. I tend to dice it up into cubes and freeze it in a bag, and then when it's time to make stuffing, I have what I need. I also will sometimes put it in a food processor and grind it up for fresh breadcrumbs when I make meatballs. I will very often start with what's called a panada, and that is a mixture of breadcrumbs, heavy cream, and occasionally an egg or two. And it's a binder that you can flavor with herbs or garlic or both, and that gets mixed into your meatballs that can make it a very fluffy texture. There are bread salads that you can make. There are bread soups that you can make. I rarely throw out bread of any kind because, bread pudding is also a classic. It's one of those things you may build up an extra stash during the course of the summer, but then once fall baking season comes,
right,
all of a sudden you won't have enough.
And what are some of the trends you see moving forward? King Arthur is always so on top of that. What are some of the things we might see emerging?
Well, I'm hoping to start a trend, actually. The next issue of the baking sheet for this coming autumn, you know how sometimes flavors come in and out of fashion.
Right.
I did an entire feature on molasses, which
I think
it's high time that molasses get celebrated, because as I was baking and testing for that, they respond to it instantly. There's kind of a time travel back to your childhood when you were remembering, you know, grandma's molasses cookies and so on. I think it's time for molasses to have a little time in the sun.
And what would you say are the characteristic flavors that come to mind?
Molasses is a little bit caramelly. It's pretty distinctive depending on where it's from. Anyone who's ever had a Mary Jane, that little candy is based on a molasses flavor. I found and developed recipes for things like molasses sticky buns. I came up with an Indian pudding recipe that I thought was terrific. There are lots of ways to really celebrate molasses in cookies and gingerbread, and it's
well.
Great
we'll look
stuff.
Forward to that. And folks who want to get the baking sheet can subscribe to that at kingarthurflour.com.
Yes, if you're on
and
the shop page down below, yeah.
And is it six times a year? Four?
Mm-hmm.
Six times.
Yes,
six times a year they can subscribe there. And there's one can spend a lot of time at the kingarthurflour.com website. There's a lot of great things there. You've done a wonderful job. Well, I know you have to head back, get back to your program, and get back to Vermont. I want to thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon, and I do hope we'll get a chance to speak with you in the future. We'll have to check in after that baking sheet comes out and see how folks have been feeling about adding more molasses to their baking.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I'm Deborah Shapiro, your host for this week's Edible Community Show, and you are listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today, our show is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, and my next guest is Allison Hooper. Allison started making small batches of goat cheese at her farm in Brookfield, Vermont in 1984. She and her business partner, Bob Reese, found themselves in the business of making cheese quite accidentally. Today, what began as an unlikely dream, I think she would say, has become Vermont Butter and Cheese Company, and they are a national leader in the artisanal cheese scene. Last year at the Fancy Food Show in New York, Vermont Butter and Cheese was picked from among 5,000 other producers and importers to win the coveted Sophie Award for the outstanding product line. And if you've dined at Le Bernardin, Blue Hill, Citronelle, or one of many of the fine restaurants throughout the country and Canada, chances are you've enjoyed some of Allison's cheeses. All of their products are still produced here in Vermont, not far from where it began, and the milk is purchased from local farmers. In addition to the original goat cheese, Allison is now offering mascarpone, fromage blanc, quark, creme fraiche, cultured butters, and some wonderful new slightly aged goat cheeses that are very new to American palates. So here to tell us more about her company and the history of the company and the wonderful world that she's created of artisanal cheese here in the U.S. is Allison Hooper. Welcome.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Allison.
Quite an introduction. I don't think there's anything left to say.
I think there's about 25 years worth.
I just told my husband and three teenage boys were listening.
You which what? I'm sorry?
I wish my husband and three teenage boys were listening.
Well, we can make sure they do. They can tune into heritageradionetwork.com and listen to the show anytime, and we'll be telling people how to do that a little later. So I do hope you could put a little bit of perspective on this whole artisanal cheese situation in the U.S. I think we're all pretty spoiled right now. We can find what is considered artisanal cheese in a lot of places. But I think that you could help us understand that it wasn't always that way. And maybe tell us a little bit about just a quick history of how things were started and some of the big spots of growth you've seen along the way.
Well, yeah. You know, you speak about how we are spoiled. We're certainly spoiled here in Vermont. We have the more cheesemakers per capita here in Vermont. Of course, you could say that about a lot of things with our small population here, but gosh, you can go to a co-op or a farmer's market and see three or four different cheesemakers with their cheeses making all kinds of varieties of things. And I recall in summer of 1985, selling cheese at a small Norwich farmer's market in Vermont as the only cheesemaker, and it was a bit of an oddity at the time. I can remember people almost feeling sorry for this poor young woman who was trying to sell nothing other than goat cheese, of all things. And, you know, in Vermont, where real Vermonters don't milk goats, it was a tough sell back then.
And what do you think began to change it?
What's that?
What do you think made, you know, started to make the difference? What were some
of
the things that happened?
Well, certainly, what's interesting about artisan cheese, I would say that it certainly started with goat cheese. At the time, in the early 80s, there were probably half a dozen women around the country, and we all had kind of the same idea. Either we had goats as we were breeding goats or showing goats, or we were in the food business and or wanted to farm, or somehow got into making goat cheese. And I would say, you know, Judy Shad in Indiana and Paul Lambert in Texas and Mary Keene in California, and Laura Chanel was actually the first in the Bay Area. We were real pioneers. We started with nothing. Most of us didn't have two nickels to rub together, but we had a fair amount of drive, and left it really to the chefs, the restaurateurs, who at the time were always looking for a new ingredient, some new trend in food. And at the time, people thought, oh, well, goat cheese is nothing but a fad. But indeed, it was a trend, and it grew. And gosh, it's on menus all over. I mean, it's pretty hard to open up a restaurant menu today without finding goat cheese someplace on a salad or in a quesadilla or in an appetizer. So I would also say that in the early 80s, the French saw the United States as this great frontier, and they did a lot to educate the American market about wonderful cheeses from France, and goat cheese was one of them. So we kind of rode the coattails of the Europeans educating us about good cheese.
Well, and I would say I think, you know, the product being delicious and good helps, and then there's some great health benefits, right? So I think that helped too, that when people started to think about cholesterol and issues of fats and dairy, if I'm not mistaken, goat cheese is actually good for us, right?
Well, goat cheese is one of these foods that, you know, I often get people say, oh gosh, you know, I'd love to eat cheese, but I can't. I'm lactose intolerant. And lactose intolerance is kind of a catch-all phrase for, you know, it's not necessarily lactose intolerance, but maybe if somebody, dairy products don't agree with them, they can eat goat milk products because the proteins are different, and they may actually have an allergy to the protein in cow's milk. And so it's worth giving it a try. The other thing that's interesting about goat milk and goat cheese is that the fat globules in goat milk are smaller. We would say they are naturally homogenized, and it's more like human milk than cow milk. So oftentimes, kids, babies who have difficulty digesting cow's milk can drink goat's milk and do very well. Same with adults that may have difficulty digesting it.
That helps with a little of the mystery for me. I appreciate that. Now, I did want to ask you also about your butter, because that's in your name, Vermont Butter and Cheese. And you make a wonderful cultured butter. And I know a lot of people have asked me, and I haven't known how to answer them, what is the difference, and why does it taste so much better, and you know, what happens in the process of culturing butter?
Well, cultured butter, I was introduced to cultured butter living in France as a student. I worked on a small organic dairy farm in Brittany between semesters during the summer. And we had Jersey cows, and we made butter. And the process of making butter on this farm was to churn raw cream into butter. And that said, we allowed the natural lactic bacteria in the cream to ferment over the course of several days. It was under refrigeration. And this developed this wonderful flavor in the cream. And when you turn it into butter, that culture flavor is just that much more concentrated. On a more commercial scale, in France, the butter is generally cultured. We don't, in the United States, we eat sweet cream butter. Mm-hmm. And that means that when the dairy separates the cream from the milk, it goes directly to the churn and gets churned into butter. And it's, you know, it's delightful. It's sweet. It's salted and or unsalted. But in Europe, they add some selected bacterial cultures to the cream. They treat the cream before it goes to the churn to develop this wonderful flavor. And I recall just loving the butter in France. Probably ate way too much of it. And, you know, and people say to me, gee, why why is the butter in France so good? Why does it taste so much better? And, you know, sometimes I've even run into people who, I can recall somebody wrote an email, you know, delighted to have tasted our butter. She said, this is the butter that I grew up with at Deitch Farm in Brooklyn, you know, as a child. And I think, you know, there might have been butter that came off a farm. But for the most part, to make it, it's a little more complicated. Again, we ferment the cream. It takes an extra day. We select a nice temperature that will promote this wonderful sort of nutty flavor profile. And then we cool the cream very quickly so that we crystallize all those little fat globules in there. And that's how we capture all the fat in the churn when we churn the butter. You know, the process of making butter, if you were to take cream and shake it in a jar, first it would turn to whipped cream and then it would break, and you would have what looks like little corn kernels in a bath of buttermilk. And so we drain off that buttermilk and work these kernels of butter and add salt and continue to work it and get all the moisture, all the water out of the butter so that we have this very high butter fat, 86% fat butter, which is very tasty and great for making wonderful sauces and pastry and cookies and great things.
People can find that, you know, pretty well distributed throughout the country, so I don't want our listeners to feel I'm just getting them excited for no good reason. But Vermont butter and cheese products are available in a lot of places and well distributed. And part of that, I'm going to sort of lead us on to something I want to make sure we get to talk about today, which is this wonderful celebration of the last 25 years that you've put together. And that's going to be happening in Vermont on August 23rd, and it's a Vermont Cheesemakers Festival. We'll hopefully have you back again on the show before we actually get to that date. But I thought we might want to just get people thinking about it, putting it on their calendar. And
well, you know, it's been a really wonderful event to organize because it feels like something that has been waiting to happen for a long time. Vermont has been known for terrific foods, wonderful artisan production of anything from, you know, cheeses for sure, but, you know, lamb and specialty meats and breweries and now some interesting wineries, terrific bread and chocolate and just very high-end foods. And it's also a great travel destination. Our state puts a great deal of effort into positioning Vermont as a wonderful getaway. It's like traveling backwards in time. We have small villages and you know, a wonderful working landscape, which is not easy to find in New England. And so we put this combination together at Shelburne Farms, which for listeners who have never heard of Shelburne Farms, it's a wonderful Vanderbilt estate on Lake Champlain. And if you Google it, it looks like a fairy tale. And Shelburne Farms is a agricultural educational center where they have summer camps and members and a beautiful inn. And our event, the Vermont Cheesemakers Festival, will take place at the Coach Barn right on the lake. And we've invited we'll have about 55 cheesemakers, most of them from Vermont, a few from other parts of New England, and actually one from Oregon and Wisconsin. And we'll have about 13 makers of beer and wine and then other artisan foods scattered in there. We also will have educational seminars for the public about cheese and how to pair cheese with wines and how to pair cheddar with beer and how cheese is made, try to demystify the process and a little bit about learning about varieties of cheese and pairing them with other kinds of food. So it's a combination of just a fun, wonderful foodie day. And
how can people get there?
Some education. Yeah.
And how can our listeners find out more about it?
You should visit our website, which
Vermont
is
VermontButterAndCheeseCompany.com, right? Vermont yep. Butter and Cheese
and
Co. C-O.
.com for our company. And then for the festival, we have a festival website, which is VTCheeseFest.com.
Great. So it's VTCheeseFest.com.
That's right. And all the tickets can be purchased online, and you'll see all the cheese luminaries and right there on the website. And we encourage people to come. We've tried to keep it accessible and just packed with good stuff. So.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be terrific, and I also think we're out of time for today. I want to thank you so much for joining me, Allison.
It's been great, and I wish you the best of luck, Deborah, for your listeners and viewers. Green Thumb Edible is great.
We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much. I'm Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains and your host for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to Hearst Ranch for making today's show possible. So how many of you are beginning and ending your days in the garden this time of year? Recently, there's been a renewed interest in gardening, whether it's on your property or in a community garden. People are getting out and getting in the dirt everywhere. And our next guest, Charlie Nardozzi, began gardening about 40 years ago when, as a young child, he would follow his grandfather around his farm, helping him hill potatoes and tie up tomatoes. Now he's the spokesperson for the National Gardening Association, an author, a recognized media personality. He's on television and radio, and he's right here on the Heritage Radio Network with me. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you on this rainy Vermont day?
Well, the storm clouds have passed, and the sun's coming out, and it feels like it's a little bit of summer out there for a change.
Which is great, because we haven't had too much of that here. And what should people be, what should they be thinking about now in their gardens this time of year?
Well, this time of year, everyone across the country have already planted everything, and things are producing, the early crops are producing, but now's a great time of year to stay on top of things, whether that be weeding to make sure the weeds don't get ahead of you, mulching around your plants is always a great idea. Keep harvesting. You know, don't let the lettuces get too far ahead of you or the radishes get too big, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then also always remember something I try to tell everyone when they're gardening, regardless of where they are, is to keep planting. You know, especially things like mesclun mixes, greens, they will come up and produce really quickly, and then they get kind of old. It's nice to rip those out, put a second batch in. Or if you're further south and you're done with a lot of your greens and your radishes and your early crops of peas and stuff, put some warm season things in, like beans and squashes. You can get two or three crops a year out of your garden if you stay on top of it and keep planting right through the season.
And, you know, I know there's different books out there. You know, people say you can garden in 30 minutes a day. Would you agree with that philosophy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, especially if you're doing vegetable gardening. There's a big push in the spring to get the soil ready and get things planted. But once it's all planted, if you do it in a way that's well-designed, and you can mulch around the paths, you can set up the planting so that they'll grow pretty much effortlessly. You know, you're not really going to have to do a lot of extra fertilizing and things of that nature. So then 30 minutes is actually a lot. I tell people if you have a vegetable garden, a regular-sized vegetable garden, maybe a 20 by 10 or 20 by 20,
mm-hmm.
you spend 5 or 10 minutes a day in there. That's all you're going to need. You know, go in and pick a few things. Pull a few weeds, maybe water a few young plants, that kind of thing, and that's all you need to do. But it's the consistency that's important.
Well, I know that some gardeners have some unwelcome guests, right, with different pests, and I noticed on your website, and if you want to learn a lot from Charlie, in addition to his books, you can go to garden.org/ediblelandscaping, and he has so much great information there. And I noticed, Charlie, that pests are kind of at the top of your list right now.
Yeah, you're starting to see a lot of the pests come in. You know, the early season pests, such as the cutworms, have kind of passed through and chopped down some of the plants. But if you have any of the cabbage family plants, the broccolis, cabbages, cauliflower, kale, you're starting to see those green worms on the plants. Those are the cabbage worms and cabbage loopers. They can really make a mess of your plants, so it's good to control those. And then even if you have potatoes or eggplants, you start seeing the Colorado potato beetle. And, of course, there are the soft-bodied insects like the aphids and spider mites and things of that nature, too. So there's a bunch of things that will be out there looking to enjoy your harvest, too. And if you can create a design in your garden where you have a variety of plantings, mixing in some flowers, mixing in some herbs, and not trying to just plant all of one thing but a variety of different things, you'll see you'll have less pest problems in the garden and less need to go out there and spray anything.
So it's sort of a natural management approach.
Exactly. If you have a variety of things in your landscape, even trees and shrubs, or maybe a little water source, you'll be able to draw in beneficial insects, draw in toads, and even snakes, which some people get very nervous about, but they're actually good to have in the garden.
A snake in the garden.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I would be welcoming one of those, but I'm going to look at them differently now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, we don't have as much time as I know everybody listening would like. I think we're going to definitely have you come back on the show, and I really just wanted everyone to get a great introduction to you and your knowledge today. But I wondered what you might want to leave people with. Is there some thought for the next 3 weeks or so you'd want to leave them with as they go out there and think about what they're approaching? Should they, one thing that they can do to make it foolproof this summer, or?
Well, I've alluded to it a couple of times, talking about mulching, and I think that's a great thing to do this time of year anywhere in the country. If you can go through and do a clean weeding and then mulch with a hay mulch, a straw mulch, pine straw if you're in the southeast, you can use all kinds of different materials, bark mulch if you're in the Pacific Northwest. It depends on what's available, but an organic mulch of some type is really nice because it will maintain the soil moisture, so if you're in a dry area, you won't have to water as much. It'll keep the weeds down. And it breaks down. It turns into organic matter that will turn into humus that will actually help build the soil structure. So to go out there and to mulch is a great thing to do in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, and it sounds like you've given our listeners lots of options for that.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us, Charlie, and I know that we're going to be talking again as we go through all the different seasons, and tell our listeners that that's it for our show this week. I welcome any comments and requests, and please send a note to me. You can send it to Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, at ediblegreenmountains.com. Let me know if there's a topic or a person you'd like us to feature. I want to also thank Hearst Ranch, and this time next Monday, you'll listen to Kate Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe. She'll be your host.
Marla Camp will follow her on June 29th, and then I'll be back on July 6th with more interviews and stories celebrating the culinary heritage of our edible communities. So thanks again to Charlie, Allison, Robin, and Susan. Until next time, enjoy.